Muslims in many countries celebrate Eid al-Fitr that marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. Palestinians denounce a proposal that they say will dismantle the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, known as UNRWA. Ukraine says it's planning to evacuate more civilians from Mariupol after dozens were brought to safety out of a besieged steel plant in the city. It's good to have you with us. The Muslims in more than a dozen countries are celebrating Eid al-Fitr that marks the end of the fasting months of Ramadan. Thousands of Palestinians marked the occasion with congregational prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque following weeks of bloody crackdown by the Israeli military in Al-Quds. The occasion was also marked by communal prayers elsewhere, including in Turkey, Yemen, North African nations, and most Persian Gulf countries. Tens of thousands of the faithful also gathered for prayers in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, and that after the city's main mosque opened to the ritual for the first time since the onset of the pandemic. Several countries, including Afghanistan and Mali, marked the Eid on Sunday. Muslims in other Islamic countries, including Iraq and Iran, are expected to mark the occasion on Tuesday. Journalist and researcher Mohsen Abbas says Eid al-Fitr is about much more than celebrating the end of the fasting months of Ramadan.
It's not a celebration that should be really, I think, taken simply as a joyous occasion in and of itself alone, because ultimately we know that on this day there are many oppressed around the world and there are people who are suffering at the same time, and it's a time when we have to share also, because in all the bounties that we receive from the divine, Muslims are encouraged not only to sort of spend on their own kith and kin, but also to the poor that perhaps surround them. Things like feeding others and serving others and being generous is equally as important as obviously creating happiness and joy for our own children and our own loved ones and family. There has to be a kind of a bigger purpose to it. And of course, nowhere more poignantly is that noted than, say, the oppressed people like the people in Palestine, for instance, today. I mean, how much will the Israelis be allowing them to live and peacefully and do those celebrations without the kind of persecution that's gone on? Yemen is the same. So my heart goes out on this Eid to those who celebrate Eid under famine conditions, under bombing and various other oppressive conditions, as well as those who have a life of ease and perhaps can, those people should be sharing all the more with those who are suffering at this time.
Palestinians voicing concerns over what they see as a potentially devastating blow to the mission of the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees. The agency chief recently raised a proposal to delegate some services to other UN agencies. Palestinians are warning of a plot to dismantle the body. Prime Minister Mohammed Shatai says that the plan would violate the UN resolutions that set up UNRWA. The agency was established in 1949 to assist Palestinians who were forced from their homes by Israelis. It's faced a funding crunch for years, regularly falling tens of millions of dollars short of its stated needs. The Human Rights Monitor says that UNRWA is a reminder that the international community has a responsibility to solve the issue of Palestinian refugees. A missile attack has hit an oil refinery in Erbil, the capital city of Iraqi northern Kurdistan region. Fire broke out after an oil tank was hit in the attack, but it was brought under control later on. According to statements by local authorities, several projectiles were launched from Nineveh province, targeting the KAR refinery. No casualties were reported. There has been no claim of responsibility either. On April 6, three missiles fell near the same refinery. Okay, now let's go back to the previous story. We had the Palestinians voicing concern about what they see as a potentially devastating blow to the mission of UNRWA. UNRWA has been in charge of assisting Palestinian refugees. So from Amman, let's bring in Daoud Kitab. He's an award-winning Palestinian journalist. Good to have you with us, Daoud. So do you share the same concerns as other Palestinians that this is a plan that's aimed at dismantling UNRWA?
You know, the timing of this and statements are very worrisome, because it comes on the eve of the renewal of the mandate of UNRWA. And so there is a lot of suspicion that it's not a mistake or a misstatement. And so people are worried. I think we need to know more of what the UNRWA Secretary General means. He went on vacation after making that statement. So we really don't know if it's a mistake or when this is a change.
Okay, how effective in the place, Mr. Kitab, has this UN body been for the Palestinians? Has it been really helpful reaching out to the Palestinian refugees? Because also we had the U.S., I remember Mr. Trump, cutting down on the funds.
Well, UNRWA has been a very important element to the refugee issue and to the right of return. And their mandate is very clear. It's very separate from all other UN agencies. And I think attempts to outsource some of its activities without clearer guidelines, and that this is part of UNRWA's mandate, is very worrisome. And I think there are reasons why people are worried about it.
All right. Thank you for that, Daoud Kitab, award-winning Palestinian journalist in Amman. So let's go to Ukraine. The authorities there are planning to evacuate more civilians from the besieged city of Mariupol, and that after dozens were brought to safety on Sunday. Now, Kyiv says that roughly 100 civilians have been evacuated from the plant, where they had been trapped for weeks. Some estimates put the number of civilians still there at more than 500. The UN and the Red Cross are involved in evacuation operation. A number of Ukrainian soldiers are also hunkered down on the plant that's under a siege by Russian forces. Moscow recently declared victory in Mariupol as it's advancing in eastern and southern Ukraine. Kyiv has asked Western powers to deliver more heavy weaponry to bolster its defenses in the east. Russia says it's targeted a supply of Western weapons in Ukraine, and that as the U.S. and its allies continue to send weaponry to Ukraine, despite repeated warnings by Russia to stop it. In the next report, we'll take a look at escalating tensions over Ukraine.
Russia's tensions with the West are threatening to quickly spiral out of control as the war in Ukraine drags on. Immediately after the start of the conflict on February 24th, the U.S. allies rushed to the aid of Ukraine. They've imposed sweeping sanctions against Moscow and provided Kyiv with military and humanitarian assistance. The size of those shipments and sophistications of the weaponry have been increasingly growing. Besides that, U.S. State and Defense Secretaries recently traveled to Ukraine, promising more military aid.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is the latest U.S. official to travel to Kyiv. There, she promised Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that more help is on the way. Pelosi was referring to a request by President Joe Biden from Congress to pass an aid package to Ukraine. The package is worth $33 billion, with almost two-thirds of it allocated to military aid. That aid includes everything from heavy artillery and armored vehicles to greater intelligence sharing, cyber warfare tools, as well as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Zelensky, said Paris would step up military and humanitarian support to Ukraine. Those measures by the US and its allies have prompted strong warnings and criticism from Moscow. Russia says the military aid is not only fueling the conflict, but also boosting the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Yet more starkly, the Russian foreign minister has warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war. Sergei Lavrov says NATO is in essence engaged in a proxy war with Moscow, supplying Kiev with weapons. On the ground in Ukraine, Russia has been targeting foreign weapons. In the latest such move, Moscow says it struck weapons shipments supplied by the US and European countries on an airfield near the southern port city of Odessa. In another sign of escalation, Moscow says dialogue between Russia and the US on strategic stability has been formally frozen. And so as Russia's warnings go unheeded in the West, there's a real risk that war will spill across Ukraine's borders before it comes to a peaceful resolution inside.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has stressed that his country could preemptively use nuclear weapons to counter hostile forces. He says that's aimed at maintaining the superiority of his country's armed forces. Now, Kim's comments follow rising tensions between Pyongyang and Seoul, especially after South Korean defense minister touted preemptive capabilities against the North.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has once again stated that Pyongyang could preemptively use its nuclear weapons if threatened. In a meeting with the top military brass, Kim expressed a firm will to continue developing his nuclear-armed military so that it could preemptively and thoroughly contain and frustrate all dangerous attempts and threatenings, including ever-escalating nuclear threats from hostile forces if necessary. His comments come as he praised his top military officials over the staging of a massive military parade in the capital Pyongyang last Monday. The parade marked the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Korean People's Revolutionary Army. It also featured the country's latest intercontinental ballistic missiles. On that occasion, too, Kim vowed to accelerate the development of North Korea's nuclear arsenal.
The basic mission of our nuclear force is to deter war, but our nuclear weapons cannot be bound to only one mission. If any force attempts to usurp the fundamental interests of our country, our nuclear force will have no choice but to carry out its second mission unexpectedly.
The country has progressed its nuclear and missile program despite international pressure over the past years. North Korea has conducted 13 rounds of weapons launches in 2022 alone, including its first full-range test of an intercontinental ballistic missile since 2017. In addition, satellite imagery has shown signs of activity at a nuclear testing site. Pyongyang has been reeling under crippling international sanctions over its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile development activities, which it maintains are designed to deter potential aggression by the US and its allies, including South Korea, who frequently hold joint military drills and weapon tests on the Korean Peninsula. Meanwhile, South Korea says Pyongyang's military tests escalate tensions and worsen ties between the two neighbors, but Pyongyang says its tests are in response to mounting tensions on the Korean Peninsula, triggered by joint military exercises between Seoul and Washington. The latest developments come as South Korea prepares for an incoming president, Yoon Suk-yeol, who takes a more hawkish approach to Pyongyang and has not ruled out a preemptive strike if necessary, vowing to strengthen the South's defense in conjunction with the alliance with the United States.
Despite sanctions, North Korea has doubled down on its military modernization drive, test firing a slew of weaponry this year. In the meantime, the U.S. is saying that it's open to talks without conditions, but has retained sanctions on North Korea over its nuclear program. Now, Washington is unwilling to have a shift in its policy. Why should Pyongyang abandon its nuclear program?
Nuclear negotiations between Washington and Pyongyang have been stalled since 2019 because of disagreements over a potential easing of US-led sanctions in exchange for North Korean disarmament steps. Former U.S. President Donald Trump met with the North's leader three times, but he refused to meet Pyongyang's demand for the removal of some sanctions in return for major North Korean measures toward demilitarization. Meanwhile, the current administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed sanctions on dozens of North Korean people and entities. Surely, that's not a sign of goodwill to resolve differences. There is also the issue of South Korea. The new president is pro-U.S., adding to the friction between the two Koreas. Meanwhile, Kim has stuck to his goal of simultaneously developing nuclear weapons and the country's dismal economy in the face of sanctions, and shown no willingness to fully surrender a nuclear arsenal as his biggest guarantee of survival.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea has always, from day one of its founding as a sovereign nation and republic, a people's republic, has always developed its military capabilities in defense against U.S. imperialism, against European imperialism.
Pyongyang has time and again stressed that the primary role of possessing nukes was to discourage threats against the country. After all, it makes sense, particularly when we look at the example of Ukraine. Even the Ukrainian ambassador to Tehran confessed that his country should have developed its military capabilities instead of relying on guarantees from foreign forces such as NATO.
And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
The economy of Palestine, the land of Palestine, is being choked due to the Israeli occupation. And when COVID-19 hit, it was not kind to either. Israel's economy nosedived and is having a hard time getting back on its feet. If only the Palestinian suffocation was eased and Palestine was given a chance to prosper. The economy of Palestine and Israel, the subject of this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, Israeli economy was hit bad by COVID-19, 2.4% contraction. GDP increase for 2022 predicted, but the businesses are reporting losses. Why is there such a contradiction there? Then, taking a look at Palestine's economy, it continues to suffocate due to the Israeli siege. COVID-19 also has had a major negative impact. The UN saying that piecemeal approach is not efficient when it comes to analyzing and approaching the Palestinian economy. And finally, Israeli occupation in terms of what it has done. It has actually damaged the economic standing of Israel, so much so that even Israelis are fleeing Israel. Israel, an apartheid regime, consequential for the Israeli economy.
It is reported that Israel's economy has rebounded strongly from the COVID pandemic. The Bank of Israel optimistically predicted that the Israeli gross domestic product would grow 5% in 2022. The economy did register an 8.2% growth last year and is on track to reach 5.5% for the year 2022. Yet, this is called a COVID-19 bounce back, which is not a sign of sustained economic growth. Let's not forget the COVID-19 pandemic caused a 2.4% contraction in Israel's economy in 2020. It was the first time that the Israeli economy, which grew 3.4% in 2019, shrank since the year 2002. And Israel is again in the grips of an Omicron wave. Some industries are hit hard, like tourism. The job market, however, has bounced back far more quickly than economists had expected. Last April, the Bank of Israel warned that consumer prices would climb faster than what was expected.
The economy of Israel has its downfalls like many economies around the world, yet it falls pale to the amount the economy receives due to the political repercussions of the occupation, while at the same time the occupation preventing the advancement of the Palestinian economy. Now here are some of the online views on this. First of all, did you know that Israel actually did not have a budget until very recently? Israel's central bank urged to meet the looming budget deadline, says this entry. This was a result of a prolonged political stalemate. No budget had been ratified in more than 3.5 years. Israel has since been running with a prorated version of the 2019 budget, something economists say was hindering growth. And it was only in November of 2021, after more than 3 years, Israel finally had a budget. Dr. Alex Komen, an economic expert at Tel Aviv University, actually broke down the milestone event.
Hallelujah. We've had 3.5 years without a budget, which means that money was handed out in something that was called boxes. Whenever there was a problem, there was a specific donation, and which means that the public had no way of criticizing or crystallizing an opinion about whether expenses were right or wrong or whatever.
So how Israel was actually making payouts or conducting a ledger is beyond anyone's accounting imagination. Now Israel is facing a dire economic fate of another kind. The cabinet of Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is on the verge of collapse. This comes after the Arab-Israeli party threatened to leave the ruling coalition over recent clashes that happened in Al-Quds. Now forget the hype about Israel being a miracle, blooming cutting-edge economy, as it's been described. Israel exists and prevails due to huge subsidies from the U.S. taxpayer. Israel would collapse in a nanosecond if these subsidies were withdrawn. Well, here is one example of the subsidy that was mentioned, courtesy of the U.S. Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid in the world. They actually offer their citizens complete health care coverage paid for by the U.S. tax dollars, while Palestinians die on a daily basis because they are unable to access health care in the occupied territories, much less pay for it, if you can believe that. All right, joining us for this segment of the Q&A is Hindi Khoury, a former Minister of Affairs for Al-Quds. Hindi Khoury, welcome. Taking a look at Israel's economy, the OECD and Dun & Bradstreet actually have said Israel's economy has rebounded strongly. It's actually performing better than the global average. But at the same time, we're looking at complaints that are made by business owners that they had seen a 50% drop in their revenue. I mean, we're seeing quite a bit of a divergence here in terms of what's being said.
Well, it would look like there is a divergence because Israel has, I think, been restructuring the economy to emphasize more the technology sector. Technology and the security sector has been gaining very, very strong grounds in the Israeli economy and has been leading growth. Truly, the situation has been bad for everybody, including especially small businesses. But Israel's economy is doing very well. It's very strong and very, very sustainable. Now, there is a controversy regarding the statistics, economic statistics, regarding Israel as a member of OECD, because the average for poverty in OECD countries is about 11%. In Israel, it's 23%. And the poverty is actually among Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship and some Orthodox religious Jews. And there is the controversy is there, is that what is Israel? In which borders Israel is defined? We know the borders are not defined. And while it controls the whole of historic Palestine, including the Palestinian population in the occupied territories, so a total of Palestinian population about 7 or 7.5 million, with 8 million Jewish Israelis. So again, the world has given Israel a free ride on how it introduces itself, how it defines itself, using ambiguity in these definitions. If it was to include, for example, all the Palestinians in the occupied territories, these are the area that it controls, then certainly the statistics will be way different, because the income per capita in the Palestinian territories is about $3,000, while in Israel it's $42,000. I mean, this is just one indicator.
It's time now for our InfoNews section, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Our first news item is on China. China's economy actually grew 4% in the final quarter of 2021. Now, that expanded it to 8.1% for year-on-year. That's pretty good. Although it's higher than the 3.6% that was predicted for the growth, the Q4 figure at the same time is the weakest growth that the country has seen in a year and a half. So we have to wait and see how things will progress in China, especially with the fact that they are experiencing another Omicron wave. Next, Germany, and a look at the economy there. It faces a recession if the war in Ukraine actually spurs the energy ban. Now, Germany's central bank is estimating that it's going to hit the GDP output by about 5%, so a negative 5% hit there. Possibly. And an embargo on Russian coal, oil, and gas is going to lead to restrictions on power providers and industry, which are examples of why a recession is a strong possibility in that country. Moving on to the dollar standing, another hit to it, this one coming from Israel. Israel is adding the Chinese yuan to its reserves. Now, the central bank is reshuffling forex holdings, reducing the dollar and euro exposure. Israel's reasoning, we need to look at the need to earn a return on the reserves that will cover the cost of the liability. Folks, U.S.'s best friend Israel is saying the dollar is a liability. That's big. And our final story in the U.S., a rising tally of lonely deaths on the streets. More than ever, it has become deadly to be homeless in America, especially for men in their 50s and in their 60s. They are dying in record numbers in places like Los Angeles and California. Now, it's quite ironic because this is while the U.S. has aided a little less than $4 billion to Ukraine in military aid, and that's just in the Biden presidency. So you could take that and chew on that a little bit and digest that. Well, those were the stories that we thought were important to cover for our InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The occupation of the Palestinian land has brought nothing but economic misery for Palestinians, all the while costing Palestinians hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars. And that is why this is the topic of our in-depth section. Well, in order to get an idea of the economic impact on the Palestinian economy, we need to take a look at how Palestine has been divided, even though Palestinians argue against this since it is their land. They've been divided into three areas, areas A, B, and C. Area A is under full Palestinian civil and security control, as it's called. Area B is a combination of Palestinian control and joint Israeli-Palestinian control. And Area C is under Israeli control. Area C, by the way, is where the bulk of the economic activity actually happens. Now, it's time to actually get a better idea of how Palestinians, as I just alluded there, have been robbed of their land throughout the decades. In the year 1974, as an example, in terms of what Palestine was, then you move on to the UN partition plan of 1947. It's pretty obvious how Israel has been forcing thousands of Palestinians off their land, occupying and illegally using it to create settlements. And as you move on through the years, those are the 1967 lines. The area in green is the Palestinian control, well, Palestinian land, and then it slowly decreases until you get to present-day Israel, which Palestinian is in the green, and look how much land they have, so much less than what Israel has. And that was Trump's plan, by the way, in terms of the division that it wanted to have for Palestinians and Israel. Again, Israel, which is in the white there, on Palestinian land again, has a majority appropriated to it. Now comes the economic impact of the occupation. This is something that is obviously very important. We broke it down into the following categories. General economic growth, $1.1 billion, loss to the Palestinian economy again. Dead Sea Minerals, $918 million. Stones, another example, $241 million. Construction, $239 million. Telecommunications, tourism, added to that. And then you come up with a grand total of $3.4 billion. Now, it's very hard to obviously get figures out of the occupied territories in terms of the Palestinian economy. So the figures and the categories that we chose, respectively, are average medians. So you're looking at about a loss of $3.4 billion that has happened as a loss for the Palestinian economy. And that is not counting the Gaza Strip. Our final look on the Palestinian economy needs to include the impact of COVID-19. That has obviously had a devastating effect, as if the Palestinian economy was not doing bad enough. UN report has actually stated in 2020 the Palestinian economy contracted around 10 to 12%. That's one of the largest annual contractions since the Palestinian Authority was established back in 1994. So the major hit that Palestinians took. That includes things like 150,000 Palestinians losing their jobs and similarly large negative impacts which are expected from the present lockdown, which is still happening. So obviously the contraction there is quite major. Let's try to get an idea about an analysis on this. Joining us for this segment is David Miller. David Miller is a broadcaster and academic, and he's a former professor of political sociology at the University of Bristol. David Miller, welcome. The Palestinian economy has been strangulated, no surprise there, based on the way that the occupation has exercised itself. looking at things like illegal settlement activities, also the confiscation of Palestinian land, destruction of property, etc. And of course, you're looking at the agriculture, how it's not being given the opportunity for it to grow based on, for example, the seizure of water. With unemployment rates at record highs, how can Palestinians actually be optimistic about their future?
Well, Palestine cannot be optimistic about the future if we're talking about the status quo, if we're talking about the continued pressure on the Palestinian economy from the occupation and from the attacks on individuals and organizations inside the territories whose livelihoods are wrecked by settlers who operate completely lawlessly under the protection of the Israel Defense Forces. So the Palestinian economy, such as it is, will suffer from more and more pressure from above, from the Israeli government, from below, from the Israeli settlers, and indeed supported by the IDF. And that will drive, doesn't everyone know this? That will drive more and more people into the arms of a united, resurgent resistance, because people have got nothing else left.
All right, indeed. Well, Hindi Khoury, the former Minister of Affairs for Al-Quds, rejoins us here to give us her thoughts on this. Hindi Khoury, looking at the Palestinian economy, again, it's really unbelievable that they've even been able to sustain themselves and actually make a living. There's so many different violations that have led to their economy being strangled, and of course the occupation is at the heart of it. Even things like minerals, the Dead Sea, mines, non-renewable natural resources, not being able to for them to reap the benefits of that. And of course, unemployment at record highs. What do Palestinians have to look forward to in the future?
I prefer not to speak in the language of optimism and pessimism, because it depends on what we do and what others do, you know, what actions and decisions are being made. If ongoing trends continue, the prospects are very bad, I think, and maybe even disastrous. We have no local economy, and this is due for a prolonged, of course, occupation, but also prolonged unemployment, continuing drop in real value of income, increased dependence on foreign aid, Israeli controls most resources, and even Palestinian decision in many ways. We have a depleted middle class. The education sector suffers. I think it's not adapting enough to new realities and new technology demands. Purchasing power is not only income is dropping, but purchasing power is also drawing. And we have major structural problems. We have defined ourselves in the basic law as a free market economy, and where are we from freedom? And we have absolutely no control over the mobility of capital and labor.
The Palestinian economy was stagnant, and the socio-economic situation was already difficult prior to the breakout of COVID-19. This was attributed to restrictions by Israel on trade movements and access, recurrent hostilities, and falling aid inflows. Despite small increase in economic growth in the first half of 2021, due to the easing of the COVID-19 containment measures, economic activity remained below its pre-COVID-19 levels, and overall growth was nearly at 3% for the year 2021. The occupied West Bank experienced a better economic recovery, but the Gazan economy contracted due to Israel's 2021 war on the Gaza Strip and the regime's restrictions and embargo on the coastal enclave. In 2021, unemployment in Gaza reached 50.2%. Chronic electricity shortages and lack of access to clean water supplies were also impacting the economy and disrupting people's daily lives.
واحنا خاشين اصلا على شهر رمضان يعني شهر انه الانسان بزيد في موضوع الطبيخ والاكل اكثر من الايام المعتاده وهيك فاحنا عم نطلع على الاحتياجات الاساسيه كلها ارتفعت مثل الدجاج الزيوت السكر الرز الامور والطحين.
It's time to have a look at the economy in the occupied territories, particularly since this is a special edition of Economic Divide. We will look at different stories to have a glimpse into both the Israeli and Palestinian economies. The title of the first piece is Tel Aviv Residents Living in Overdraft in the World's Priciest City. This is Tel Aviv. It's marked by expensive high-rises, busy highways, and also construction activity. But Tel Aviv is known for a disease that plagues many economies, and it's called inequality. Described as one of the most expensive places to live in, many Israelis can't afford to reside here. From food to clothing, prices are astronomical.
And I just visited my daughter, and I can buy anything in Manhattan, in Chelsea, or the Upper West Side for a quarter of the price, which is ridiculous. I go to the supermarket and I don't believe it, the differences of prices, from vegetables to fish to everything, to toilet paper.
Time to see what Palestinians experience in their own motherland. Keep in mind that this land is theirs, occupied by Israel, and this is the type of worry they have to deal with. This is the main thoroughfare through the Wadi al-Jos area, close to Al-Quds' old city. This is lined by mechanic workshops, but the Palestinian business owners in occupied Al-Quds are worried they will be forced to shut down their shops by Israeli authorities over plans to build a vast high-tech hub in their neighborhood. Remember the Bahrain conference? It was part of the so-called deal of the century proposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump, which, like him, failed and joined the dustbin of history. Palestinians were offered economic rewards if they accepted Israel, but many Palestinians declined that offer. Here are boxes of unsold biscuits piled up in a West Bank warehouse, a sign of the tough economic times faced by Palestinians, yet who are determined not to be wooed by Washington's economic pledges. The Palestinian owner of the West Bank warehouse refused to give in to the U.S. offer, neatly packaged in the Bahrain conference. And our final piece goes to Palestinian businessman and billionaire Munib Al-Masri. Here he is, walking near a fountain outside his mansion Beit al-Palestine in Nablus. And this is how he feels about the way Israel has dealt with Palestine.
The Jewish state means we don't have anything. During Balfour 1917, he called us a non-Jewish community. We have the right to go to the mosque and the church and to rule ourselves by municipality, but we have no political right whatsoever.
That does it for my section. I hope what we compiled for you could give you an idea about Palestine, which Israel calls its own. One day, it will get liberated.
The story of Palestine and its occupation has entered a new phase, the new phase of world recognition on a massive scale. Israelis are leaving Israel due to a lack of political will of Israel to solve the Palestinian issue. Israel needs to make a choice. That choice is to give back the land of Palestine, which it will never do. Meanwhile, the status quo cannot remain. Surely the Palestinians' resolve and resistance will overcome the Israeli apartheid regime. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thanks so much for being with us. Your questions and comments are always welcome. Do send them to us. For me, Kavit Ahwai, and the team, it's goodbye until the next program.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته, and welcome to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We are looking at human justice, and we are looking at it from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful. Now, we spoke about how Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam valued justice itself, and how he stood against oppression, and how he grieved with the oppressed. We want to look at the value of life from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Because at the end of the day, human rights itself and justice and all these concepts, they would not exist if life did not exist, or human beings, like their life, was not present at all. We live at an age where life seems to have less value by the day. We're living in a world where wars are constantly happening. People are constantly dying. There's not a day that goes by without people being bombarded by bombshells and being killed on a daily basis. And the whole world just watches and does not care at all. I mean, obviously, to be fair, not all, but the majority of the world doesn't seem to be care. In fact, when it comes to the matter of death and life, it became also a source of joy for a lot of people. Where, for example, if you look at Hollywood and the media mechanism behind it, they seem to make death sound very interesting, rather very entertaining. Because when you see all these action movies, hundreds of people get killed in it, and, you know, presumptuously or assuming that they are bad people. But people being killed, and it doesn't seem to affect us when we see so much death happening on the screen on at least movies. Even they brought that notion that life has no value in terms of making it a game for little kids. And kids, you know, they don't understand much of these things. They just want to, you know, entertain themselves. So they play these games where they're constantly killing people. As they grow older and older, life, and it has no value to them anymore, which is sad. And that's why you see increasing amount of crime and killing happening around the world, because now we're trying to glorify the loss of life. You know, if you're looking at games, is how much people you kill, you get a lot of stars. When you watch movies, the more people get killed in an action movie, the more entertaining it is. And when you see kids and families being, their lives being torn apart by wars, it doesn't seem to affect us anymore. So pretty much, we can conclude to the fact that life itself has no value anymore. And that is very sad, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He created humanity based on the fact that they are living creatures, and life itself is sacred. in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and it needs to be preserved. Let's take a short break and then we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Now, going back to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam and his universal concept of human rights. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he himself has helped people to acquire their rights and made them recognize what was due to them, because a lot of people are unaware what their rights are and how to acquire them. Where he paved the way and he told them what their rights are and how they should go upon seeking it and getting it. Also, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he also shared their hardship with them. And he shared the hardship with the indigent and the deprived. And so that he needs to feel the value of human rights and justice from their perspective, because when a person is sitting high on his throne and far away from the people, he can't really understand the suffering of people. And that's a problem that we face today when we look at the systems that we live under. It's oppressive systems clothing itself with democracy and freedom, where in fact all these systems fail to preserve life or human rights for its citizens and for the people of the world. So when we look at the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, we get to see all these principles and how he have made every effort to create a sense of belonging and a sense that every human being should be treated equally, regardless of their race, regardless of their color. He laid a new foundation through his work and through his sermons, through his eloquence, through his jurisprudence, through his social science, and so on and so forth. He laid the foundation for human rights and the value of life itself. And you get to see how Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, in many of his sermons, especially when he goes to battle, where it is Safin, where it is the camel, or where it is Nahrawan, he never initiates war, and he says we need to come to terms and seek a peaceful outcome, because I don't want be blood to be shed, despite the fact that you guys are my enemies, despite the fact that you guys are corruptors. I don't want to shed blood. There are better ways to solve this and resolve this. So every time he would go to battle, he would send one of his men with the Quran, and he would go to the opposite army, and he says, look, we don't want to be the first to initiate war. We want to have peace. And you can read through history that the opposite army always are the ones who end up shooting arrows at the messengers of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi and initiating war and putting Amir al-Mu'mineen in a position where he has no choice but to start a war. So the life itself was preserved in the sight of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, and he looked at it highly. Inshallah, we will look at this topic furthermore in other episodes. So until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.